We celebrate Digital Equity Week because digital equity means living life with dignity.
We believe that digital inclusion means affordable broadband for everyone.
And we believe in
digital equity for all.
We believe in internet for all.
At NDIA, we're dedicated to building connected communities.
Happy Digital Inclusion Week!
What you just heard was actually a PSA, and that is for National Digital Inclusion Week 2023. It runs from October 2nd through October 6th. If you've never heard of it, don't feel bad, because this year I am learning more about Digital Inclusion Week than I ever have. That PSA was supplied by National Digital Inclusion Alliance. Probably never heard of them, but that is digitalinclusion.org is their website. And there's a couple of things that they're all about. I'll read their mission. Their mission is to advance digital equity by supporting community programs and equipping policymakers to act. And their vision is that everyone has the opportunity to use technology to live, learn, work, and thrive. And so it's been very fascinating just kind of digging into this. When you think about all that the pandemic laid bare in 2020, it pushed so many people to these digital platforms, and I think Zoom, which we'll have an interview on here shortly, is probably the most popular of all those platforms. And it also made people more aware of what they did and did not have in terms of digital access. It made people more aware of the speed of their internet. It made more people aware of the need for internet. When schools were pushed to online learning, a lot of students, I can't speak for where you are, but I know that here in Pennsylvania, a lot of students had to be supplied laptops, because even though electronics are very prevalent in the average household, laptops, not so much. And so today I want to focus on that a little bit. We brought in different people from different parts of the country, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Dallas, all to talk about their role in not just Digital Inclusion Week, but the efforts that they're involved in their own local towns, and how they're trying to collectively make a difference in the digital inclusion space. And so again, this interview is via Zoom. I'm sure that you'll hear that in the sound quality, but the knowledge and the information disseminated in this interview will more than make up for the fact that it does not sound like a typical studio recording. And so without further ado, I bring you our interview with four key players for digital inclusion in the African-American community. All right, thank you guys for tuning in. This appreciate so much you taking the time to talk about the digital divide, Digital Inclusion Week. There's a lot of information that we've gone over when it comes to this particular topic. And so to give the listener the opportunity to really plug into your knowledge base is something that I'm very excited about. I get the feeling that this is a subject that a lot of us have limited information on. And if this isn't the space that you operate in, many of us just aren't really up to speed on the subject as much as we should be. So we're looking forward to getting educated on the topic of this digital divide. First, I want to start by allowing everyone to introduce themselves. And I'll start with you, Mr. Moses.
Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Sandy Moses. Right now, I own a company called MyWiFi.net. And what I'm doing is I'm specializing in building data centers and affordable wireless internet service for local communities. At this moment right now, I work as a network engineer for Windstream. And I have been in the industry now for almost 40 years. And I watched it grow from your old phone, where you had the dial pulse phone, to what it is today, where the phone is in your hand. I built out the wireless infrastructure for Sprint PCS from Cleveland, Ohio, to across the southern tier of New York, the northern tier of Pennsylvania. And we handed off in Newark, New Jersey, and we handed off in Buffalo. We optimized that network, and we made sure it worked by doing a single call from New York all the way to Seattle, Washington. In my past, I was in the military. I was a technical controller. My job was to go into places that were war-torn, or that the U.S. was going to do any invasions in. And my job was to go in and build or take over the existing telecommunications infrastructure and make it for our use. So I've got a pretty extensive background. I hand it back over to you, Marcus. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Carmen, introduce yourself, please.
My pleasure. So my name is Carmen Dawson, and I've had the luxury of being in the broadband space since 1996, not quite as long as my dear friend Samuel. But I started out in sales and ultimately had been relatively successful, top 5% in sales, number one at times. And I had the luxury of working with Fortune 100 companies that have mission critical infrastructure. I had to build redundancy within the network, multiple mirror sites and alternative, backup redundant vendors so that there was always uptime, and had the luxury of working with some significant companies that acquired inferior or companies that were going out of business. And so I had the experience to when a network provider would actually acquire another network provider, where we had to convert all the network equipment and the switches and the customer base and apply the proper billing mechanisms to convert. And so, just super excited to be involved in Digital Inclusion Week. We're doing an initiative called the National Broadband Inclusion Initiative that really layers on top of some of the great work that NDIA does. We're aggregating, the best of the best to include Sam and Odie and Kenneth into a national initiative to where we continue to work together and to impact communities in a meaningful way. And so I appreciate this opportunity and I look forward to the discussion.
Excellent. Mr. Odie Gray.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. My name is Odie Gray. I am president of Diversity Cyber Council. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, and we provide cybersecurity and technology training to residents of underserved communities, focusing on Black and Brown communities. What I bring to the table in terms of value is just my wealth of experience. I have been a technology professional for the last 15 years, working with organizations to improve their cybersecurity maturity. And I also have insights into the industry, obviously, where we see there is going to be a major workforce transition related to automation, which is what led us to establish our nonprofit and to meet people with equity from underserved communities and getting them trained and certified so that they can be prepared for that transition and remain employed. So thank you for having me.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And Mr. Kenneth Yancey, last but certainly not least.
So my background is software, telecommunications, and marketing. I came from Cisco Systems, IBM, and Sprint. Yes, I was at Sprint PCS and Sprint LTD, all that in Kansas City. So my wife, I'm with the Essential Family. So my wife owns a nonprofit. I'm the chief digital marketing data and software officer for her nonprofit. What we do, and according to the city of Kansas City, we have solved the digital divide. My wife looked at it from a child and family development perspective. She's been doing that for about 30 years. She quit her job right during the pandemic, came home and said, hey, I want to start my own nonprofit. The problem is she brought me home all this paper. And so what I did was I turned her paper into some AI machine learning and a lot of relational MySQL databases. We have a lot of data. So we've got some programs running right now. Met Carmen, and things just kind of opened up. He knows a lot of people. He just knows a lot of people. So I'm just glad to be here to listen and learn about what you guys are doing and just share how we're closing the digital divide, not just in the urban core, okay? We're also doing some things in the rural relative to telehealth. Mm-hmm. Telehealth is a big, big gap. And so we have a solution for that as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And so if you're listening right now, you don't have the benefit of seeing these gentlemen. I do because we're on Zoom, but these are all African-American men. And again, as I stated in the beginning, I think this is a space where we just aren't aware of how many people of color are operating in this space. We hear about the digital divide. Some of us have varying degrees of knowledge where that's concerned. But we don't oftentimes, at least in the area I know, we don't see a whole lot of African-Americans or people of color in general going after this. And so I'm excited about this meeting. Carmen, let's start with you. Digital Inclusion Week, I'll be honest, it was something I didn't even know existed until my relationship with this group. Talk about Digital Inclusion Week, if you know anything about the genesis of it and the importance of this week. This year, it falls October 2nd through 6th. Talk about that.
Sure. The National Digital Inclusion Association is the founding entity that launched this respective Digital Inclusion Week. A majority of the members of that respective organizations are municipalities, education systems, healthcare, and government. And we were fortunate to get involved with it flying under the healthcare umbrella. But the reality of it is there's individual organizations having events all over the country, and they're trying to reach a variety of different demographics. And the core group that are supposed to be incorporated into this week are those above 60 years old, those that are in resettlement communities, minorities, veterans, those that are disabled. You know, the general premise is we feel and they feel very similar that broadband and having equitable broadband is fundamental to the success of communities, families, and businesses. And those that are unserved and underserved need to be addressed. And so the team in this particular call have a very unique approach in solving the digital divide, which I'm sure is going to be divulged here during this particular. But the general thing is there's their website, you know, has a variety of events that they're having. We're going to have an additional event on Friday. But, you know, there will be a variety of libraries having events. There'll be digital skills classes taking place. There'll be petitions, you know, approaching, you know, politicians with the need for more ACP and funding for ACP. And so I'm just very excited that, Marcus, you took an interest in taking a lead in making sure our beloved community of Erie County is you know, attached with organizations and initiatives that are doing so.
Give us a little bit of the backstory pre-pandemic, because people are now starting to think about this more because of COVID. But before COVID, this divide was an issue, and it feels like it was a pot on the stove kind of boiling. Somebody speak to that, please.
I think it was back in 2007, 2008, Carmen and I first met. There was a competition here in Erie for a business plan. It was just for business plans. And I actually introduced the need for broadband and wireless broadband here in Erie, Pennsylvania. And unfortunately, no one, there's only one person there who took it seriously, but no one else did and didn't move on it. And I know it may have taken 12 years for it to really stand out, but we knew that back then that this place just did not have the infrastructure in place. So it's something, if we did need to go to any type of online education or training, it wouldn't be done easily.
Samuel, give us a feel for some of the indicators that you just noticed around you that led you to that conclusion in 2008.
Well, the biggest indicator that I saw was even in some of the restaurants here in Erie, they didn't have that free Wi-Fi that you would get if you were in a larger city.
Yeah.
I saw that the library didn't have Wi-Fi. And even if some places did have a Wi-Fi connection, it was a connection to a DSL line. So you try to get 5 or 10 people on the same DSL connection, that connection is basically as fast as dial-up. Mm-hmm. And I think what we see here is, I think I saw that this area seemed to be lost in time by about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Odie, speak to that the conditions before the pandemic that helped you understand that there was a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to make sure no one gets lost in the lingo, when we're saying wireless broadband, we just talk about internet, y'all. You know, there is a gap in home internet for underserved communities and people who live in rural communities. And right now you can go Google on your phone, the Affordable Connectivity Program, so that you can get, if you qualify, your home internet bill reduced or at no cost. So that's the call to action to the audience and listeners. If you are on any type of government aid or assistance, Google the Affordable Connectivity Program and go ahead and sign up and enroll. so you can get that for free. Because that's ultimately what we're discussing right now, is how do we bridge the gap as it relates to getting people who need it reliable and affordable home internet. Because internet, access to the internet has now become a basic human right,
right,
in the modern era. If you do not have reliable access to the internet, you are cut off from the world, right? And you're cut off from opportunity, and you're cut off from knowledge, right? Because the internet is the data superhighway, and you have to have access to it to remain informed. So there's the call to action. Then in response to your question, what were the indicators pre-pandemic that was kind of like signaling us that this gap is relevant or was looming, right? And ultimately, I would say it was less overt signs, and it was more subtle signs. Like, you would have to be in the industry to really, really know, you know, what's on the way, from Web3 being on the brink, from quantum computing being on the brink. Like, you're seeing all these, like, which a lot of these things are still yet to be commercialized, but they're a lot closer now than they were. But you're hearing the theories of what's next, and you're realizing that what is common knowledge and what is industry practice is so far beyond, right? And I'll give you guys an example. Me being in cybersecurity, still to this day, some people use their password as password, right? And that in itself shows and highlights that people do not know how valuable their personal data is, right? I can foresee a very near future where people will be able to get paid based on organizations processing their personal data.
Right.
Right. We see data protection and privacy being much more stout in the EU, European countries, mm-hmm. than here in the States. But that is about to change in a major way. So I'll end on a capri here. We've seen that once the pandemic did hit, Zoom prices went up, you know, working from home became an obvious thing. And that's when it was really revealed, right? That's when it was really like, okay, due to the lack of affordable or reliable home internet, a lot of people had to adjust. Even organizations and companies had to adjust. So I think the initial signs were less overt, but once the pandemic did hit, then that was the big light bulb for a lot of other people.
Gotcha. Kenneth, I see your head going as Odie was talking.
So 30 years ago, I was an outside plant engineer for Sprint United Telephone, right? We were designing broadband networks for the suburbs. I was told then, I was pretty proud about that, but I was told then they started in the suburbs because that would subsidize the urban core. That never happened. Never happened. Okay, so, and I can tell you why it didn't happen, because I lived in the suburbs at that time, and I had Google, right? But when I went home to my mother's house, she had AT&T, DSL. I was paying $100 a month for my Google, and I didn't have a gig back then, but I had about 500 megabytes down and probably about 200 up something back then. But she had DSL. She was paying $300 a month for DSL, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about 3 meg down and maybe a meg and a half up. It was really bad. So, yeah, if you look at what is going on right now, this is not new. This is not new. I was also part of the dot-com thing, working at Cisco. My team, we built eBay. We built Priceline. We upgraded Yahoo. And I'm going to date myself again. Some of y'all remember when AOL had that busy signal problem.
Mm-hmm.
That was because they went from offering you email, right, to introducing you all to this browser world. When you started to browse on what we call narrowband, that's your DTMF. That's that dial tone stuff that Moses was talking about. So people are online longer. So busy signal. So anyway, all we did was, they dropped my team in there. All we did was yank out modem pools put in AGS Cisco routers, and boom, we brought you all broadband internet. Mm-hmm. It came from AOL. That was the first platform. And check this out. There was a kid working there, intern. He was a software developer as an intern. So when AOL shut down, I saw all this. When AOL shut down, he took a piece of software with him, right? His name was Mark Zuckerberg, right? He took that software. Now, if you remember AOL, they had an instant messaging platform. What was that name? Messenger. Mm. What's Facebook's? Messenger. So, but Steve Chase, you can Google all this. He didn't say anything about it because he was already a billionaire, and he didn't think Mark was going to do anything about it. But Mark is not winning. I won't get into Mark Zuckerberg. But yeah, so I agree with what Odie was saying and what Sam was saying. Now's the time to do it. But again, we can't make it, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, looking at our data, if we make it strictly about race, right, we probably won't get that much attention. We've got to make it about economic development. Right. We got to show by bringing these underserved people into the economy that already spent a lot of money, that's going to help everybody.
Right. And Kenneth, you're setting up my next question because I guess on a scale from 1 to 10, the underserved that are on the negative end of this digital divide, based on your interactions with people, how much does it seem that they understand how much they're behind the eight ball? Does it seem that everyday people even recognize that this problem is as big as it is? Or does it seem like people just don't really have a strong sense of the urgency of the matter? Anybody can speak to that.
So the short answer is no. People do not truly understand what is on the way. So workforce, everybody's afraid of AI. When in fact, they're thinking like Terminator, robots, things of that nature. Robots are on the way. They're going to become a common part of our society, but that's not the biggest and most immediate threat to I would say, our society and our economy. The most immediate threat would be workforce automation. So workforce automation is what what they're currently doing is investing in systems replacing people, right? A lot of low-skilled positions will be automated by 2030. No question about it, by 2030. And we're already starting to see some of that take place when you go to your grocery store, you see the self-checkout line at Target or grocery store. Or even if you go out to eat, you're starting to see robots bring you the food, right? So you're going to start seeing cleaning robots at the airports. You're going to start seeing more of these systems to take these low skill positions, right? Mm-hmm. Restaurants, McDonald's launched, I want to say, 3 fully automated restaurants requiring no human intervention this year. So expect that number to rise dramatically next year, and not just with McDonald's, but Wendy's, KFC, all the other restaurant retailers as well. So think about, now that you see kind of the scope of how this is happening, now think about the people that it's going to affect the most, right?
Right.
Now, these organizations, these companies, while they may seem very forward-thinking initially, it actually, to your point, Marcus, is kind of, they're not thinking about the long game and long-term impact. Yes, you only have to pay a machine once, where you have to pay a person twice a week, although that person is going to purchase your products and your services. A robot is not. So by you taking away that money from that human worker, you're also taking money out of the economy, right? So and the black dollar is one of the most, I would say, our black consumers are high value consumers. And they are going to be some of the, I would say, demographic that is most detrimentally impacted by this workforce automation shift, right? Because mm-hmm. we assume a lot of the low skill positions, so if we don't have a proactive transition plan that's going to teach Black and Brown communities technology skills, so once the shift occurs, they'll still remain employable. This nation is actually going to experience one of the biggest national layoffs that we've ever seen, which again, mixed in with what's going on at BRICS, mixed in with, you know, the inflation of the dollar, having historic numbers and unemployment is not going to be good for our economy. So
this has the potential to get ugly. And I got to tell you, you hit on one of my soapbox issues, Odie, because I remember once upon a time Walmart talking about, oh, we're going to have more cashiers. We're going to ease the tension. I know these lines are long. Here we are years later. I'm like, damn, I'm the cashier they were talking about. I'm checking out my own stuff. Shouldn't I be getting a check for this?
Well,
you got me checking out my own stuff.
Well, you think about that self-service model. That started with the gasoline industry, right? Remember, we used to go and pull up and
come
out and pump your gas. But see, they raised the price, and we had to do our own work. So they're very profitable right now. They're very profitable. But let me say this. There's a lot of you guys may have heard of MLMs, chasers. That's getting to lawyers looking for problems and all that. Let me say this to you. That is, to me, this is just my opinion, that is occurring right now with AI. You got people talking about AI who really don't know what it is. So let me just throw this out. If anybody comes to you and say they know about AI and machine learning, just ask them one question. Ask them one question. What is neural networks?
Yeah.
What is that? If they can't answer that question, they're just here to sell you something. Let me tell you something. 1994, I was in Sprint's think tank. We were experimenting with neural networks in 1994. Why? Because Sprint had a federal contract, okay? The government had the supercomputers. You have to have a lot of processing power, bandwidth, and storage back then to implement AI. So Sprint had a federal contract. They threw me in the think tank. And all we were trying to do was get our networks to mimic the human brain. Here it is. Machine learning is real simple. And it's nothing to be scared of. But if you have a bad developer who gets AI, you're going to get bad AI. I'm not a bad AI developer. I'm a good guy. I am. I can say that about myself. But check this out. Machine learning, AI, is two facets to it, okay? The human brain has to learn, has to gather data, right? And really gather and learn. That's machine learning. Once it gathers the data, it has to process that data to make a decision. That's artificial intelligence. It's that simple. So if anybody runs up to you and says, I'm an AI, no, check my credentials. I am an AWS fellow. I don't brag about it, but this platform you're on, this guy here, Eric Yang, who built this platform, he and I worked at Cisco together, right? He's an Asian brother. He leaves Cisco, runs out with his Asian friends. I applaud him. I'm not hating on him. He did a great job. He leaves Cisco, hooks up with his Asian friends, VC friends. He raises millions of dollars to build what we're on right now. It's called Zoom. Eric Yang and I worked at Cisco together. I leave Cisco. I reach out to some VC, you know, no. So what I do is I start streaming church services for 28 churches, making $30,000 a month. That's all I did for 2 years, 30 grand a month. I'm fine. I'm just pressing buttons, right? But here's the difference. And Eric, I wish he was on here. Eric and I were at Cisco when Cisco bought WebEx, okay? And you look at what he has you doing, you have to download something, install something. That's how Cisco taught us. Again, Eric should not be, you know, he's behind. You don't need to load anything on people's machine. Eric is installing software on your machine. I'm talking about Zoom, because his network doesn't know the difference between audio and video.
Right? Interesting. Interesting.
I have audio. That's me talking. You got to have video. That's me. His network is 11 years old. He's a billionaire, right, and all that. But his network is 11 years old. I have COVID, January 2021. I'm asthmatic. They threw me in the hospital. They put the Resivir, saved my life. I believe in God. God kept me here and all that. He did. But check this out. I called my wife and say, hey, I need some money. She said, for what? I said, well, we got to build a better Zoom. She said, why do we need to do that? I said, what Eric built is not going to be able to handle what's coming to him. He's going to have audio problems. He's going to have jitter problems. And he's going to be having people download all this stuff. This sounds familiar to anybody. So anyway, again, so one of these days I'll show you our platform. Karma knows it. I call it Now. Sitting on AWS, and it's a whole, I'm not selling anything. I'm just telling you. My point is, back to the job thing, we've got to expose those who want to be exposed to what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
right? We've got clients right now. We've got a waiting list of 650 people on our waiting list that wants to participate in the digital divide. One of the carrots, how we got their attention, we give them free laptops. We've got funding from 7 foundations in the city of Kansas City and the state of Missouri, right? Mm-hmm. We're giving away laptops. That's how we get their attention. We bring them in and we show them, right? You have to participate in this digital divide solution. Why? Because you saw if you're at home and you have to work from home. Someone said that earlier. But by being at home, I've got 173 clients that tells us all the time, I saved more money during the pandemic than I ever saved in my life. Why? Because they were not paying $300 and $400 a week for that daycare.
So let's talk about this $65 billion that was put forth by the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act to try to close this digital divide. Of this $65 billion, how much are people of color? I see Brother Yancey poo-pooing this. How much are people of color participating in that large chunk of capital that's been designated to try to close this?
Yeah, I believe the NTIA through the Department of Commerce had released $46 billion as part of the infrastructure plan. And, you know, highways got $228 billion. Odie, I'm going to pass this one off to you because you did a significant amount of research on this stuff. And I think you'll get right to the data sets that he's seeking.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Carmen. So I wrote an open letter to Congress about the inequitable kind of planning associated with the National Plan for Equity, right? Mm. It's counterintuitive, but yeah, we are often left out of the funding pool as it relates to government grants, and it's just the overall design of how these funds are not only distributed, but the requirements that are drawn out that inherently almost, I don't want to say prohibit, but indirectly prohibits Black-led organizations due to size, location, and other factors, right? To Carmen's point, I think that the government is on pace to spend, I want to say, I think about $4 or $5 trillion this year. Less than 1% is being spent with Black organizations. So that just goes to show. And what I wrote inside of the open letter is that this nation was founded on no taxation without representation. And what we need to do is come together as a collective and say there will be no taxation without equitable redistribution of wealth. Because that $1 trillion, that $4 trillion comes from each American, right, through our taxes, and the government redistributes it to these other entities. So without us being a part of that pool, then we're losing dramatically on the funding front as it relates to the federal government. So is that helpful?
It's extremely helpful, and that's very frustrating, Carmen.
And then
Brother Moses, I want to get your take on this once Carmen gets done too, please.
Okay.
So just in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, there is $1.6 billion just allocated. We are, one of, I think, 8 that really brought in a lot of money. Florida, I think, was $1.17 billion. Yeah. And both unique have like 67 kind of counties, which is kind of unique there. But the reality of it is that the National Broadband Inclusion Initiative was solely created to ensure that we had the government lobbying backing. We had the technology in place to help with compliance for municipalities and ISPs. We have all the trainings required to for the digital equity for navigators. To become ACP through our partnerships here, the NOFOs of the NTIAs, specifically say a couple things. Okay, first and foremost, you have to have a lead technology planning team. Okay, that has to be comprised of community members from a variety of different expertises and talents. And then you have to have a regional broadband leadership team, which is supposed to be composed of, you know, banking, education, agriculture, healthcare, a variety of different demographics. So they're both supposed to be able to come together and say, hey, this is how our industry is using broadband. These are the things that are important to us. And then we're supposed to use tools to do mapping. We're supposed to roll out a testing technology to test the throughput speed so we could help in building the maps. And so I don't think anybody's even pushed a map in certain communities so that we can actually test the throughput capabilities. And essentially, there's supposed to be these inclusive teams that are supposed to work together to put out this map technology where people go and test their speeds in their business, home, or church. And it's supposed to show you when there's inadequate speeds of 25/3. And so the reality is that communities are bypassing the inclusive process of using this mapping tool and then planning according with the unserved and underserved data sets that come back, from any rural or urban community. It's unserved and underserved are supposed to be the priority of these funding. And so the reality is that communities are forgoing these processes that were listed in the NOFO so that they're ensuring inclusiveness. And they're also, we're supposed to be able to illustrate how, of these 8 core demographics that I mentioned earlier, the above 60, the disabled, the minorities, the veterans, the tribal, those that are homeless, right? They're supposed to be included in this digital equity initiative. And so, my challenge is, my hope is that we can get more involved in issuing this mapping technology within our respective communities and start making our own maps and plans.
Samuel, this is a lot to digest.
Our own digital equity plans, and programs to reside on it, to build the workforce, to support the build out of infrastructure, the cybersecurity relevance of network infrastructure. And I don't want to go on all on a roll here, but there's a tremendous void. I know Odie and I have this a slight disagreement. I said, I'm going for 1% of that $1.17 billion for the Commonwealth. Just give us Black folks 1%, right? Just let me get some of that. And he was like, oh, no, I'm not trying to go for that 1%. I've been in the diversity, spend game for a long time. So I thought the low ball, just give us the one for Black folks, and you could do the him, she, the other stuff, or, wherever else you're giving monies away, but let us Black folks get our 1%.
So this is interesting information, and at the same time, it's concerning. Samuel, speak to this, add some additional context, because just listening, first, let me thank you all so much for, I'm learning a lot, and I know our listeners are learning a lot from this. Again, I see a lot of opportunity, but at the same time, it's also very alarming, because when you don't know, there's an old saying, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a lot of people of color on this menu. Absolutely. And they don't understand that people are ordering them up right now like filet mignon. Samuel, talk about this a little bit. Give us your perspective on all of this.
Well, my perspective goes back to pre-civil rights. Mm. And it goes back to thinking about what it was like for my parents having to buy a house in a neighborhood that they bought it in Philadelphia, where the neighborhoods were redlined.
Mm.
And what we're seeing here is, I believe, is something similar.
Yep.
Because they tell us that there are opportunity zones in all these areas, but who is getting the money for the opportunity zones?
Right.
I'm not getting it.
Yeah.
And if you apply for it, the documentation that they require of you to apply, you have to have information about, they ask you questions about stuff that someone who's new and starting a business would have no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. they already put that in front of you, that they put the carrot out there, but then they put a wall in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we had to take away. That's what we had to be able to knock down, is that wall that's put on. And I go back to thinking about what it was like when Booker T. Washington brought up the, Black Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own finances and resources. And I think that's what we need to do here now, is that apply for that resource. And when you get that resource, keep that resource in that community, in that area, make your own economic environment. Make it so that it's continually feeding itself.
Yeah.
It's like if I
economic empowerment ecosystem.
There you go.
If I worked in this neighborhood and I live in this neighborhood, I'm going to spend money in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that's going to keep the tax base of this neighborhood growing.
Yeah.
So sooner or later, people are going to stop renting, because that's when you get your power. When you stop renting from somebody and you buy a house, then you get more power, because now you don't depend on that person to give you something that you're going to pay them for.
Right.
Now all you're doing is, yeah, you may be owned by the bank, but you're not owned by a person who can kick you out of your house anytime he wants.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
And I believe we need to bring that same ecostructure back into our communities.
I completely agree with what Sam was saying, and it's going to require a lot of us building with us, right? We have to heal as a community, and we have to connect and do business with one another with the same energy that we have been looking to do business with some of these major corporations. And they don't understand our experiences, right? Yet we're looking for them to meet us with equity. That's where we're misstepping, right? It's
point.
Like, this is our experience, but I'm going to a predominantly white organization who don't understand where I grew up, what I've been through, any of that they're going to be able to give me money and help fortify my success. That is not even in their social bubble, my experience. Can't relate to that, right? But everybody on this call, I guarantee you, there are so many life events that we share in common. That should be our point of to build off of. That should be the foundation of our relationship. Like, hey, I've been through this, you've been through it too. In that we share trust, in that we share bond, and we got to do right by one another. So that's where the healing and the building have to come into play to create the future that Sam was kind of describing.
Mm-hmm. I want to give Kenneth an opportunity to kind of take us to the finish line, because I'm hearing a lot of some of our major players in this space that you've had some sort of occupational affiliation with. Give us your gut sense in terms of where this is going. We know that it's a digital inclusion week for a reason. We know that there's this gap. Give people an idea of how you feel inside about where is this going? What's needed? Give us the cliff notes of that in your mind, because you're drawing from a wealth of knowledge in this particular area.
Well, let me say this. I think everybody's opinion is important and valuable, but there's nothing more valuable than data. You got to get the data. You have to be able to do what happened in 2017. You can Google all this. So something happened in 2017. Data became the most valuable asset on planet Earth. Mm. It's more valuable than petroleum, oil, you know, that stuff that, you know, we fight over and kill over. Data is more valuable than that. So all these programs that I'm seeing, and when Terry asked me to help her, you know, again, a lot of nonprofits, they tell a lot of good feel stories, right? They get feedback forms. But I told Terry, where I come from, everything was driven off what we call key performance indicators, right? In other words, if it didn't make money, we stopped, readjusted until it made money. Nonprofits, they just tell good feel stories. I said, Terry, everything that I build for you off this paper, my wife is very organized. She gave me 24 years of background, spreadsheets, right? Sticky notes, and this colorful sticky notes. They're all color-coded. No, anyway, so my point is, get the data. Whatever you're doing, be data-driven. Don't be feel-driven or feel-good-driven.
Right.
Understand who you're talking to and what you want to talk to them about. What has happened during this pandemic is we have a lot of data, but the data, to your point, Mark, is the data became richer because we were online longer.
Right, right.
Back to that machine learning. Okay, I'm talking about Alexa. I'm talking about Siri. I'm talking about Google. All that is machine learning. And how long has it been around? Okay. And then the other thing is, so that's my end point is, And I just highly recommend. I see a lot of great things happening, but I don't see people presenting their data.
Right. Excellent. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for the information. We want this to be the jump off of a continuous conversation, and not just continuous conversation, continuous calls to action, as Odie pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, so that we can actually take tangible steps to take our rightful place in bridging this divide. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Next on WQLN. I'm your host, Marcus Atkinson. We will see you next time.
Good job, Marcus.
Thank you very much, Marcus.
Out, gentlemen.